So I want to begin before we get into the halacha. I want to begin with a little bit of stuff, a little bit of Shalom Bayis. There's different ways of looking at the time designated by the Torah, the Zman of Nida, the Zman of Isser. And some people, especially right after they get married, they view it as a necessary evil. In other words, the Torah said you have to do it, but it's difficult, and it's hard, it's pointless, and you don't really understand the purpose of it as much. The longer you're married, the bigger an appreciation you get for it. And what's important to understand is that there's different levels of depreciation, which means as follows. What begins to become more and more obvious as the longer you get married is that you understand that what the Gemara says, that what's the purpose of Nida, what's the purpose of a woman that being asr for 7 days, Lama Amra Tayrasha Tiasar Nidal Shiva Yamim, Kidei, that when she becomes mutter, she'll be Chaviva al Baila Kekhala Biyaim Chupasa, that when she becomes mutter, it'll be as exciting for her husband and herself as the day that she got married. So that's something that people become, as like I said, the longer you're married, the more you appreciate the fact that it's a necessary fact. It's a necessary to have the absence, which makes the heart grow fonder. That through the fact that we have this time, that we're separate, and it's mechadish, it brings the eschatches, it brings something new to the table. It gives it breathes life into the relationship. And as you remember, in the secular world, not that I know that much of what goes around in the secular world, but from what I understand, that even the people that do successfully manage to stay married for a long amount of time, but their intimate life basically peters out, you know, pretty quickly because of a lack of eschatches, or they resort to all sorts of strange things to make it interesting. Whereas a yid, the value is in the relationship, and that through this vehicle that the Torah gave us to take a break and start and stop, it gives it this eschatches and this chashivus, and we all understand what it contributes to this man hetter. So that's easier to understand. But what we need to understand more, and we need to take advantage of, is that it's not just that when we're the time that HaKadosh Baruch Hu made that we should be usher, it's not just for the purpose of making the time that we're mutter better, but there's actually a purpose in the time that we're usher too. And we're supposed to utilize that time. It's not just, let's take a break so that we can get to the next step. The time that we're usher has its own specific definitive purpose. And the purpose of the time that we're usher is to work on the relationship and develop the relationship in a way that you can't necessarily do when you're able to be physical and when you're able to be intimate. And there's a beautiful vart from, I think it was from the Maral, the part that we say in the Shevi Brach is Asha Bara Sasa V'Simcha Gila Rina Ditsa Chedva Sasa V'Simcha Ava V'Achva Sholem V'Reyus. So he says the first part, Gila Rina Ditsa Chedva, which are expressions of great joy, that's referring to the time when you're mutter with your wife. It's Azman Heter. That you can come to through the physical connection, which is truly the ultimate form of connection with your wife, of cementing your relationship together. That's when you come to Gilarina Ditsa Chedva. However, during the Zman Isser is the time to work on Ava Achva Shalom Bereis. That's when you have the opportunity to really work on the Ava Achva Shalom Bereis, on the relationship between yourself and your wife, when it's not diluted, and I shouldn't say diluted, but when it's not when it's not overtaken by the physical aspect of your relationship. And more than anything else, to all our wives, that is the real acid test when they see, you know, truly where the relationship is holding. If you're able to relate and you're able to connect and you're able to show love throughout the time of Isser as much as this man Heter. So I want to just point out three points which are very important, then we'll move on to the halachas. But the three things which are really the cornerstone of every marriage, and you know, over the years when I've been speaking to people and taught chasanim and heard different things, these three things are really, really the basics, and they tend to be overlooked. Sometimes to begin with they're overlooked, or sometimes you know about it in the beginning after you're still fresh from your chasan shmuz, and then it gets forgotten. But it's something which has to be constantly worked on. There's three ways that you have to relate with your wife, and you should utilize specifically the time when you're usa to strengthen those ways. You have to show your wife that you love her. And there's ways you can show her that you love her. There's, you know, this famous joke that, you know, a woman comes to a rav or a marriage counselor and complains that her husband never says that he loves her, that he loves her, and the marriage counselor turns to the husband and says, is that true? She said, yeah, you know, 20 years ago we got married, and I told her I love her, and I let her know. If anything changes, I'll let you know. You know, so that's a joke. But you think it's a joke, there's actually truth to it. In other words, I've seen it acted out. Not as extreme as that, but there is a measure of truth to that. So a woman has to hear that from her husband that he loves her, and that means you have to say those words, I love you, in any language, whatever language you speak. A woman has to hear that, and she has to hear that from her husband. That's without question. And you can say that when you're in either two. You know, it's when the harchaka, that you're not supposed to be schaik and kalas roish, and you're not supposed to say certain things which are dvarim hamargilim la'arva, there's certain things you're not supposed to talk about when you're a nida, we would classify that as you can't say romantic things. But to say I love you, that's like the bread and butter of a marriage. That can be said anytime and has to be said at any time when you're married. So that's not included in that particular harchaka. Now, other than that, there is now two very important ways that a woman sees that you love her. One is through action, and one is through words. Words is by complimenting. Complimenting, now, very important point here is that complimenting doesn't mean general complimenting. Now, think of it when your kid comes over to you, a little kid, and he drew a picture, right? And you're on the phone, and he shows you the picture, and you say, yeah, that's very nice, right? So what do you mean? You mean, please, get away, I'm trying to finish this phone call. That's what a general compliment is. Anytime you tell someone, oh, this tastes great, you know, or you look beautiful, you should say that too. But just the general compliment is almost an insult. Because really, that's what it means. It means like, you know, I'm being yaitza, I'm not like really paying attention, I'm not concentrating on what's going on. And for a compliment to be effective, and it's incumbent on all of us to compliment, is to specify something specific that you're complimenting on. If you want to compliment the food, say something about it. This was done so well. This was finished perfectly. This tastes so good in this way. So compliment something about her appearance. That this outfit looks good on you. Not just you look great, you know, or is this new? It's fine if you know or not. You can fake it. But the point is you're noticing and you're paying attention. there's a number of stories of all the Gedolim. They were very machped on this, to compliment their wives and to give specific compliments. And this is about food, where to these Gedolim, there's no question that food was abhorrent to them. They did it only as a necessity, but they complimented wives specifically. Rabbi Lapian says that the Alta from Kalm, you know, who probably didn't even concentrate at all on what he was eating, he used to compliment his wife. He would eat challah Friday night. He'd say, Mamish, this challah tastes like cake. He wouldn't just say, it's great, the food is good, thank you very much. He would say something specific. He would compliment in a specific way. The Chafetz Chaim, who if he enjoyed his food, he immediately stopped eating. There's a Rav that says that's equal to Kamatan Asim. He would always compliment his wife on how delicious the food is. So this is something which is, you know, obviously, we understand the need for it, but we don't always recognize how much of an integral part of the marriage it is. If your wife doesn't hear that, then she doesn't hear that you're appreciating what you're doing, what she's doing for you, and she then translates that as a lack of love, which in effect it is. You know, if you're not putting your heart into it, and you're not concentrating, and you're not giving over your koyach into what's being done, then you are lacking. You're not appreciating the relationship, and you're not valuing it. So that's a very, very important part of words. You have to say I love you, and you have to compliment you, and you have to compliment in a specific way. You should keep a record for yourself. I mean, if you're doing it, great. But if you're hearing this and you're wondering that, do I do this or not, there should be at least once a day that you're doing this and saying a specific compliment. And if you're not, then there's work to be done. There should be, could be more than that. But at least once a day, a specific compliment should have been made. Then there's showing your wife you love her with actions. There's helping out in the house, and then there's, you know, helping out with the children and helping out with her things. I just saw now, this past week, I was looking when Rabbi Yaakov Galinsky's Sefer, and it was just funny the way he wrote it. He wrote that, he was writing about being a mensch, so he wrote, you know, and it, know, your wife is eating, it should really help, and you should clear the table, and really, if you want to do it with a shlemis, you should wash the dishes. And they said, that's if only she ate. But if you ate, that's not chesed, that's pashut menschel chayv. Of course, you have to help clean up. But regardless of that, the act of helping is, women will tell you, is more arousing than anything you can say and anything you can do. It's the most powerful thing you can show to your wife that she means something to you. And all in all, you know, you have to show your wife that you appreciate what she's doing for you, and she has to know that you appreciate it. She has to hear from you. It can't just be that, you know, you're not complaining. You have to tell her how you appreciate everything that she does for you, and through the fact that she sees that you appreciate it, she'll be very happy to do it and very happy to continue, because she really saw her main rutzen is to please you as much as, you know, as she can. That's her happiness, if she sees that she's making you happy. And lastly, there's, when you're giving time to your wife, you know, whatever time you're giving, the klal is ta'iv ma'at b'kavana miharbe shloi b'kavana. It's, if you're giving time to your wife, then it should be time for your wife. You know, it's very difficult nowadays when we have so many things around to distract us and take our attention away from what's important. I remember seeing, you know, on the back of the Reader's Digest, they have these, like, paintings, you know, contemporary paintings. So there was this painting of a man and his wife sitting in a restaurant, and one is facing this way, one is facing that, both on their phone, and the waiter's standing there, like, waiting to try to take an order. No one's paying attention to anybody. That's a very common sight nowadays. You know, you have a man and wife, they're taking a walk in the park, they're ostensibly spending time together, and they're both on their phones, talking to someone else. So the quality time means quality time. If you, whatever time you can give hours and hours, but if you aren't really focusing, it's worth next to nothing. And in the relationship, it's worth next to nothing, and your wife won't feel like you gave her time. And it could be very frustrating. You took up all this time, but you don't realize that if you're not focusing and you're not truly giving time, 10 minutes of that is worth more than hours of without that. So those are the three things that, you know, we can speak for an hour about it, but I just wanted to start off with that. Is, you know, it's work that is continuous, it's work without end, and it's work that specifically during the Zman Isser is when you should be focusing on this. When you're mutter, you have so many other ways to relate to your wife, so many other ways physically to show her that you love her, but that can't cover and make away with the need to show her that you love her in all these other ways, through complimenting and through observing and through appreciating and through specific compliments and through quality time and all those. The time to do that specifically is when you're asa. So the Zman Isser, not only is it there to make the Zman Heter better, which is something we all understand easily, that you need that Zman, that break, to make it better, but the Zman Isser is there for it itself, so that you can have the opportunity to relate to your wife in a real meaningful way and to develop the relationship more and more and more. May have asked her. So let's start with the basics of Hilchos Nida. So obviously we don't have that much time here, so I want to try to focus on things that are commonly misunderstood, you know, for what I've been hearing, not here specifically, but over the years. Things that are common, often people make mistakes about, and we'll touch a little bit on all the different halakim of Hilchos Nida. So first let's begin with how a woman becomes a Nida to begin with. Right. So the classic way that a woman becomes a Nida is that she gets her period. Now, what's interesting is that the Torah says, didn't talk about a period, the Torah says a woman becomes Aser when she has a Hargasha. What's a Hargasha? There's various different types of Hargasha, but this feeling of Hargasha, this sensation that she's getting her period, is something which is largely extinct nowadays. It used to be something that was so powerful, it could wake the woman up in the middle of the night. It was something that was impossible to be missed. Nowadays, it's just about not relevant anymore. So typically, the way a woman really becomes a Nida min HaTorah nowadays is through the fact that she's getting a flow, she's getting a full-blown period, and a full-blown period means when she really needs to start changing her pad, when it's enough of dam is coming out regularly that it requires her to really be on top of it. So every woman knows herself when she's getting a flow. That makes her into a Nida Daraisa nowadays. What's interesting is that there are some women, depending on certain medications that they're on or whatever it is otherwise that's affecting their physique, that they can sometimes not get a period, a proper period, whereas they'll get some form of dam, they'll see some form of ra'iyah, but it'll never be a full-blown period. So they can go through a full cycle where all they're doing is spotting. So they're seeing, like, they don't need to change their pad at all. They have to wear something, but they don't have to change their pad. They can go through a whole day with one pad, where a normal woman who's getting a period has to change it 2 or 3 times a day. So she's not getting a proper period. She's staining. And if she's wearing colored, you know, so she never became usher, and if she's wearing colored, so those stains are just ksamim. They're just stains. They're not a full-blown flow. Each one is only like a quarter or a dime or whatever it is. It's more than the shir, but it's on colored underwear. She hasn't become tame yet, so she's not required to wear white, and she shouldn't put in a tampon, because that would make her usher. So the fact that she's getting a little bit at a time doesn't necessarily make her usher. So the reason why I'm mentioning this is that if you do have such a situation, you shouldn't assume just, you know, out of hand that you necessarily have become usher because it's the time that you get your period. Unless you get a full-blown flow, you haven't necessarily become usher. This is also relevant, as we'll see later, that you only really count your period from when you get your full-blown flow. And this is relevant to how you figure out when your vest is, right? Or how you, and we'll see soon about, we'll talk about when the 5 days start. So you have to know when have you become a proper nida, and that is when the flow begins. Sometimes it can start very slow, right? Many women, they'll start very slow with just a couple of spots, and that'll be during the daytime. And then at night is when it develops into a full-blown flow. So then they have become a nida at night. By day, they weren't a nida yet. By day, it was just a few ksamim. That when did they actually become a nida? When the flow started. That's what makes a woman a nida midaraisa b'zman hazeh, getting the full flow. And if the full flow started at night, that's when the nidas began, and that's when you start making your cheshbon. Now, we know, though, in stains, so that's the halacha of a kesem. If a person stains, there's halachas of when a stain can make you aser, and the reason why they have all these qualifications is because it's only a drabanan. Min ha-taira, a stain really doesn't make you into a nida. Min ha-taira, you only become a nida, like we said, with a hargasha, and nowadays, with a flow. However, a stain, midrabanan, will make you into a nida, provided that all the halachas and tanaim are met, which is it has to be on white, it has to be on a davar ha-mekabel tumah, and it has to be on a shear, it has to have the size of a gris, which is either bigger than a penny or bigger than a nickel, whatever it is, but it has to be larger than that in order that it should make you awesome. Right? So that's the halacha of ksamim, which make you asa midrabana. Now, sometimes this confusion, which I hope no one has this particular confusion, but I've heard this, that people are under the impression that that's by everything. Every form of a stain has this halacha that it has to have a shear. And that's not true. It's only a stain on underwear or on bed clothing or on a nightgown that has to have a shear. But if you did anything which is the equivalent to a bedika, which means anything which went into her body, whether it's a tampon or it's a bedika cloth or it's an instrument, a doctor's instrument or a doctor's glove, anything that went into the body, that went within and actually entered the body, at that point, then we say any tiny speck of blood that's on it will make the woman usher, and we consider that even an issur d'oraisa. And the reason is because we assume there was a hargasha. Why it's like that, why we do that, is a long discussion, not for now. But that's the fact, that's the halacha. So any time anything enters the body and there is some dam on it, that will be a question of issur d'oraisa, and therefore even the tiniest speck of blood will be a problem. So any time a doctor does an internal examination, you're not required to check his glove. But if you do see something on the glove, then you have to ask a rav because it could be a problem. And then we have to see, did he touch the cervix? You know, maybe he caused the maka. There's always what to talk about. You have to know what to ask the doctor. But the fact that you found something on his glove or on his instrument, or if a woman puts in a tampon and finds anything on it, it'll automatically make her usher, even the tiniest drop of dam. That's why it's not a good idea. If you're in that midway stage, you're not usher yet. I mean, if you're expecting a full-blown period, then fine. You're welcome to make yourself usher earlier if you want. But if you are not necessarily going to become usher, by putting in a tampon, you're effectively going to make yourself usher. So that you could or might want to avoid that. And likewise, a bedika cloth, even the tiniest drop of dam, is going to make you usher because it went inside the guf. Now, this is only something that actually goes inside the body. An external wipe, if a woman wipes herself with a tissue, that's just an external wipe. That didn't go into the body. So therefore, that's the same like a stain. So when a woman wipes herself and there's some dam on the tissue paper, that's the same like a regular kesem. Now, what is the status of this tissue paper? So the status of the tissue paper is typically we consider it to be a Dharma She'eina Mekabel Tumah. Tissue paper is the most paiskim, that's where I go, is that tissue paper is not Mekabel Tumah. So a stain on the tissue paper, even if it's a big stain, is going to be mutter. Now, if it's a tremendous stain, you know, so then it's like could be already at the beginning, that's considered the beginning of a flow. There is some point when a stain is a flow, right? Just for argument's sake, if a half a pad gets filled up, that's not a stain. That's the beginning of a flow. If it's a stain that I can't give you there's not an exact science, but if it's like this big or whatever it is, once it's a sizable amount, then that's basically we'll just say that's a flow. You know, a flow can start and stop, but that's considered a flow. So a wipe again has the halacha of a kesem, and likewise stains on anything on clothing or on underwear or whatever as a kesem, where even if let's say the kesem is not making you tame, because let's say we're saying tissue paper is not makabel tama, or underwear could be colored, so it's not a problem. But if it's too big, you have to ask a rav about it. So the levels are as follows. A flow will always make you aser, I don't care what it's on. A very big stain is equivalent to a flow. So a big stain is equivalent to a flow. So anytime you have a very big stain on something, even if it's uncolored, even if it's during a zman heter, if your wife is nursing, pregnant, whatever, besides seeing a doctor, the big stain has to be shown to a rav because that could be a problem. If it's just a regular, typical size stain, which it could be big, you know, a quarter, 2/4, 3/4, that's fine. And then it's subject to the regular halachas of kesem, where it's depending if it's white and if it's darav makabel tuma, and tissue paper is not a darav makabel tuma, and that would be okay. Toilet bowl also is not a darav makabel tuma. The toilet bowl can get a little confusing sometimes to gauge how much is there, so you can do your best. But a toilet bowl also is not a darav makabel tuma. A tissue paper is not a davar makabel tuma. Those are all okay. But if anything went inside the guf, whether it's a tampon, a medical instrument, a doctor's glove, or a bedika, obviously, even the tiniest speck of blood is a problem, and that all has to be asked to a rav. Now, there is a tendency of women that they see red in more ways than one. But when it comes to this, I mean, I remember once when I was learning with my father-in-law, initially learning Maris, he showed me a Mara and he said, "Do you see anything on this?" I didn't even see anything on it. He said, "The woman told me it was tomato red." There was nothing on it. And in subsequent years, I've heard that a number of times, where, you know, if maybe, you know, I use my imagination, I could see a shade of pink, if I use my imagination, and the woman says, "I know, there's really nothing to talk about, I'm for sure usher, but, you know, I'm just showing it to you anyway." So it's very important not to come to your own conclusions when it comes to bedikas. Now, if it's red, it's red. I mean, hopefully, you know, a man, you know, will know the difference when something is red. But you should know that there are many shades of brown which are mutter. There are many shades of brown which are mutter. So just because the thing has a dark color doesn't mean that it's usser. There's a lot of other stuff that comes out of a woman's body. There's mucus and etc., other things that come out. And it's dark brown. It could be close to black sometimes, where black itself is a problem, but it's very unusual. So there could be dark colors that come out. It doesn't mean that she's usser. It very much can mean she's mutter. And it's depending on, again, what medication she's on, it could become very usual. So all of a sudden, you can see something that you've never seen before. Like, it's unusual colors coming out on the dikas. And it's just a hormonal change that can cause that. But it doesn't mean that she's usser. So a color is not necessarily a problem. It's red that's a problem. And browns, there are different types, are not don't necessarily make a problem. So it's always very important to ask a rav. You're not going to surprise me with anything, no matter what you show me, whatever you tell me. I've heard it before. I can't say. You know, you can always learn something new. But I'm just saying, this is very unlikely that it'll be surprising. Nothing to be embarrassed of. You know, I remember when I was a chassan, so my chassan teacher was telling me, you know, so if you find a stain on your underwear, what do you do? So I was saying, I don't know, you just show the underwear to your rav, and you cut it out maybe. So he said, look, unless your shver works in underwear, I don't suggest that. It can get expensive. So yeah, you can bring your underwear, there's a place, you know, we'll leave it in I have a box there for shiloh, designated for shilohs. You can leave the shiloh in there, I'll leave it back in there, you can take it away. And, you know, and it can all be done discreetly. Now, women have been indoctrinated by the Kala teachers, and slowly but surely we're trying to change this tide, but there is this thing they've been told and told time and time again, don't look, don't look, don't look. I don't know if you've heard about this, maybe you have. This concept that when don't ever look at the toilet, that's like one of the Aviyah Vais Atuma, stay away from that. Now, this is a big misconception. The reason why this started, why the Kallah teachers, to their credit, why they did get into it at some point, was because there was an OCD issue. There was an OCD issue. There were women that were going crazy, and they were constantly checking themselves again, and they were wiping themselves so many times, they were causing themselves to bleed, and then they became questions of Aser. And if you know, unfortunately, it's very sad, but the taba of OCD is that one time, 100 times, doesn't help. You could tell them again. I remember when I was in Beis Hara, a woman called up, and she said, she was makdam, I'm OCD. So I knew it was a problem already, and she said, really, I already spoke to a rab, and the rab told me I shouldn't ask any more questions, and this is exactly what I should do. But I know from my therapist that unless I talk it out with someone else, I can't help myself. And she went on to ask me for another 20 minutes the same questions, but Rav had already told her, don't ask these questions anymore. So as a result of that, and a result of the fact that these things don't end, so they tried to institute this don't look. Now, the problem is, it's not really halachically correct, which means like this. You don't have to look for trouble. That you have no obligation to look for trouble. When we go to the bathroom, she has absolutely no obligation to look. She doesn't look for trouble. But if she has a reason to believe that she might be bleeding, for whatever reason, she's seen spotting before, and she has a good reason to believe that there is some damage, she should be looking. And I had a very sad story. It was right when I joined the Beis Hara. I wasn't even officially part of it. I was subbing for someone, and a woman called. I actually knew who her Kallah teacher was, and she was in tears because what had happened was she had been spotting, but she was being very stark about not looking. And really, she was spotting quite a bit, but she wasn't looking, so she didn't really know. And then she was together with her husband, and he found dam on himself. So that means he was a boil needed. Right? He was found nothing to talk about. So she called the rab, she told the rab that my Kallah teach me, don't look. And he had very bad bedside manner, and he made her feel terrible. And she called me, and she wanted to find out what it's all about. So my point is that it could have very bad, very bad things can come out of this approach, where obviously everybody would understand if you're bleeding, you have to know what's going on, right? So this don't look just means that you don't have to look for trouble. You have no obligation to look for trouble, that's true. But if you do think something is going on, you should be on top of it and you should look. So that should be made clear. Now, as far as, and when you've all learned, I'm sure you've heard that, when you find dam right after going to the bathroom, it's a question how long and how quickly afterwards. So the truth is, though, for the most part, this halacha is not so relevant, because even if it's very short amount of time of space, which means after she's gone to the bathroom and then she wiped herself, as long as it's even 10, 15 seconds or even less, that she didn't immediately wipe herself, it'll be okay if there's dam on the toilet paper, because the toilet paper, like I said, will be a kesem. It's only if it's mamish immediately afterwards she saw dam, or if she actually saw it with her own eyes, obviously. If it was the second after she finished, she wiped herself, that's when it'll be a problem. But if she's doing anything else, like there's, she's reading or she's doing anything else, it's very, very rare that it's a problem. So, again, if it does come up, you can ask and we'll talk about it. But I of all the times I've been asked this Shaila, I don't remember even once that it was actually a problem. The only time it was a problem is because the woman actually saw it on herself. She didn't even see it on the toilet paper. She saw the dam on herself. So that was a different story. But finding dam on the tissue paper is almost always not going to be a problem unless it's a large amount. So feel free to ask that question. I'm embarrassed. And it's most likely, more often than not, going to be mutter.
What is mine when the should check herself?
Should? Other than shivanikim and bedikas, you mean? So I'll tell you like this. Let's say this happens. Let's say a woman stains, right? And she's bezman heter, she's not expecting her period. Sometimes it happens, you have breakthrough bleeding, nursing it happens, again, if you're on certain medication. So the halacha is as follows. You're not usur, but it's not advisable to be together because you don't know what's going on. It could come again, and you don't want it to happen right before or right in the middle. That's very uncomfortable, it could usur you and all sorts of things. So all Rabbanim pretty much say everybody gives a different amount of time, whether you should wait a 10-hour break or whether you should wait 24 hours, some Rabbanim say, okay, each person to their own, but I would give you a good 10-hour at least, l'chal apachas, after you've seen a stain. So let's say she's seen a stain in the morning and hasn't seen anything the whole day, so if it's a full day, you could be together that night. But I would suggest then, at least, wiping yourself first and checking. Not internally, just externally, but it is advisable to wipe yourself first just to make sure that nothing's going on, and then you could proceed. But Again, you know, unless if sometimes it's happened that it's like very negative, they have to be together at night, the husband's going out of town, there's not going to be away, around for a couple of days, so like there's actually some special reason they want to be together that night. So that is permissible with at least a decent amount of time, but that's one good time that Yutaka should check to make sure nothing else is coming out. Other than that, aren't required to.
So
you're not obligated.
Hours after the last kesef.
Right. Again, provided that, you know, you're not expecting a period. Well, if you're expecting a period, that's a different story. Each case for itself. I'm sorry?
About the man?
Meaning?
Checking himself? Ever?
Never. You should never. You should wipe yourself with a dark towel. Yeah, no, seriously. It's something you should avoid. Don't look for that. Don't look for that problem. Okay. Now, let's talk about how a woman becomes tar. So, after a woman becomes tamei, so you count 5 days. And those 5 days are Zman Isser. And then you start to shiva nikim. So again, I imagine everybody knows this, but unfortunately there are people that get confused about this, that it's 5 and 7, and day number 5 doesn't double as day number 1 of the 7. So it's a total of 12. That's the total, it's important to know that. Shiva nikim starts after 5 days have ended. These five days begin from the Torah's opinion of a day, which means that if a woman got her period 2 minutes before Shkia, that counts as day number 1. So even though she's only had 2 minutes of that day, that's enough. It goes with the Torah's gather of a day. So 2 minutes before Shkia, that's day number 1. So let's say it happens Sunday at late afternoon, right before Shkia, the Sunday is day number 1. Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Thursday is day number 5. That's when you do your Hefsik Tahara before Shkia, Maich, and Friday is the first day of your Shiva Nikim. Now, there is times when the 5 days can even begin without you properly becoming usher. Like if you've gotten, let's say she's staining, so she hasn't really become usher, but it's a regular staining so that you've been effectively pirish, you've separated from your wife because she's staining. So there are times when you can even count that as the beginning of the 5 days. Typically, it's not so relevant because generally most women, I can't speak for all, but most women, it takes, when they start bleeding, it takes 5 days for them to become tahar. But if it's relevant, you can speak to me. Now, if you have been pirish because you considered her, you treated her like anida, even if she didn't halachically become anida, if it's relevant, you can give me a call. There are times that you can start the 5 days earlier, but typically we count the 5 days from when she became properly anida, when she became usher, when she got the flow. That's when you start counting the 5 days, and then also is when you count for the best also. So like if she was spotting Sunday afternoon, and only Sunday night, which is really halachically Monday, is when she got her flow in earnest. So Sunday night is when she counts her best from. That's when she got her period, and that's when she chajbins her best. So if Monday is Gimel Adar, so Gimel Adar is her Yom HaChodesh, the night of Gimel Nisan is going to be her Yom HaChodesh, and so on and so forth. In other words, from when, even though she had started bleeding earlier on Beis, but she didn't actually have a flow until that night, the proper flow, the night is when we count her best, that's when we consider it to be real nida, that's when we, the Yom HaChodesh, Haflag, etc., all the vestas are counted from that night. Now, when a woman does a Hefsik Tahara, so Hefsik Tahara needs to be done before Shkia. What happens, which very often happens, especially when these early days in the winter and you come home from work and whatever, so what happens if you miss Shkia? And you do it a couple of minutes later, so all is not lost. You have to call her up. There are situations where you could be mekel. It's funny. Litvish apaiskim tend to be very, very makbid with shkia. That once it passes shkia, they don't allow anything. Chassidish apaiskim are understandably more mekel. There was one chassidish rav in the Beis HaRav that when he would get a phone call about shy like this, he would say, "Call me at home." Over here, I can't answer you. Yeah, so in the Beis HaRav, they followed the rulings of Rosh Lama Miller for the most part. But Lamaisa, it's not only Chassidish Baiskim. There, Ashura spoke to Rav Gusman and Rav Moshe as other Hatayim. There are a number of other Hatayim that are applicable. It's on a case to case basis. So if you just missed it by a minute or two, depending on the case, don't give up. You can give me a call, and it's possible that it can still be used. A woman can make as many Hefsik Tahara as she wants. She can start. She starts whenever she wants to start. You can start from Plaga Mincha Katana. and make hefsek taras. By the way, it's just a good idea. My wife, when she teaches kallahs, she always suggests this, that even though a hefsek tara is supposed to be made in the afternoon, it is a good idea, especially if you're going to be at work during the time that you are supposed to make your hefsek taira, or you might be traveling. You can make one in the morning, and have in mind, you'll do one later, but it'll be a good backup, that just in case something goes wrong with the one later, like you don't get to do it, or you get to do it too late, so b'di'eved, you can be samech on the one in the morning. In other words, l'chadchila, you can l'chadchila make a hefsek taira in the morning, with having in mind that you'll make a second one, and if just in case it doesn't work, so then b'di'eved, you can be samech on that hefsek taira. It's a good idea, especially if you are worried, you know, what will happen later. It's a good idea to make the one in the morning just as a backup, just in case. Not to rely on it, obviously, but if it does happen, at least you have that to fall back on. Now, like I said, you begin to make your hefsek taira, whatever it is, a half hour before shkia. Let's say you started, you made one, it didn't work, it was bad, two, three. You can make as many as you want. You can make 100. You just have to have a certain amount of time in between them. You can't make them mamish back to back. Exactly how much time in between them is not clear. So if you did a proper rechitza, which means you took a shower, or even if you washed it very, very well, so after washing, you're supposed to wait a little bit more time. You're supposed to give it 5. So you have to give it time to dry off. So you should wait like 5-6 minutes. If you're down to the wire, like it's right before shkia, you know, just do it, and we'll speak. But you should be given more time. But between hefsiks, in other words, you can one hefsik and another hefsik, you don't have to give that much time. 2 minutes is really, really enough. So you can make a hefsik, you can wait 2-3 minutes, and make another hefsik, and that's fine. That's l'chadchila. There's also this is really for the women to know, but you know, if your wife is complaining that the hefsik is hurting her or the bedikas are hurting her, it is possible she's pushing in too far. Now, even though it's interesting, the Beis Yosef, when he describes how deep a woman has to make a bedika, sounds like you have to go till your elbow. But in practice, if you speak especially to the doctors and to the women who check the bedikas. And especially now, women tend to push too much. They touch the cervix, and they cause it to bleed. And it's a makkah, and they're making themselves usur unnecessarily. So it's important. You should never push. You should push in as far as you can go. You couldn't go past. It's possible to go past your second knuckle, but if for whatever reason it's starting to hurt, stop. Then you're pushing too much. You should not hurt yourself ever. You never need to do that. There are women that it's very tight, and they need to use KY or some other lubricant. So the best way to do that, Rupaiskim do allow it, but the best way lubricant should be used is not by applying it directly to the cloth. That's not l'chadchila to apply it directly to the cloth. It should be applied to yourself. First, the woman should apply it to herself, the KY, you know, put it in and get it all around, and then wait, because that's like sort of washing yourself out, and then you can wait like 5 minutes, and then do the bedika. Obviously, if there's still a problem, you know, so then we can speak, you know, on a case-to-case basis. But that can be done l'chadchila. You can put KY if you want to use KY, but use it on yourself and give it some time, like 5 minutes, and then make the bedika. Now, maich dachuk. So the key with a maich dachuk, if provided that you're doing it, the key with a maich dachuk is that it has to be inserted before shkia. If you don't put in the maich dachuk before shkia, it's pointless. You're not doing anything. The point of a maich dachuk is that it should be there from before shkia till after teis. How long is teis? This is a drabban. It's not even a drabban on a maich dachuk. It's really a minig. So obviously you can go with the shortest zman. Half hour is fine. Half hour is l'chadchila. If it's painful, you could go even less than that. But you could keep it in there a half hour, and that's fine. But it does have to start before shkia. If you miss shkia, there's really no point in doing it. The point of a maich dachuk is to be there in the before shkia till after teis. Very often, women are pater from doing a maich dachuk, especially after childbirth, because again, since it's a minig, if it causes her any pain or any abrasion or anything like that, anything unusual, it's never comfortable to have that there. But if it's more than just uncomfortable, if it's causing her what doctors call discomfort, so then b'derech chal she'll pater, she'll be pater. So you know we can speak about that obviously case to case. But many times you can be makel with a maich dachuk. Now, how many bedikas does a woman have to do on Shiva Nikim? So that we all know, you have to do 14 bedikas, and we should realize, it's important to realize, that each bedikah is a mitzvah drabanan. It's a mitzvah. You mekayim a mitzvah drabanan, like eating matzah on the second day of Pesach, shaking a lulav on the second day of Sukkot, third day and fourth day and fifth day. It's a mitzvah drabanan to do a bedikah on each one of the Shiva Nikim, and therefore it is not a simple thing to skip a bedikah. If you forgot, you forgot. But it's not something to just drop. It's a mitzvah with the same chashivas as any other mitzvah drabanan. There are times when a rav will allow a bedikah to be skipped, when there are issues with bleeding, issues with makis, you know, issues with pain. Any one of those issues are situations which will allow a bedikah to be skipped. Typically, a rav will prefer that even if you are in a situation that you can skip bedikas, it should be 1, 3, and 7, rather than just 1 and 7. And the reason for that is because, like this, you did 1, and you did, let's say you do just 1 and 7, right? And then, which very often happens, especially since she's not doing bedikas every day, she forgets number 7. That's very bad, because if you forget number 7 and then you do bedikah day number 8, officially you have to start all over again. The two bedikas can't be used together. Once there's more than 7 days in between the first and the last bedikah, that nullifies the first bedikah. So really you have to start all over again. That's why the Paiskim always try l'chachila to be 1, 3, and 7. So even if you forget day number 7, no big deal. Then you could do it on day number 8 because there hasn't been a 7-day span in between your bedikas. So that's why even if you are in a situation where you're skipping bedikas, obviously you'll do what the Rav tells you to do. But if you just want to understand why they tell you 1, 3, and 7, 1, 4, and 7, that's for that reason, in order to avoid this problem from happening, which does tend to happen very, very, very frequently. Now, after a woman does her bedikas, so on the day she has to go to the mikvah, she does a chafifa, which is the washing, the bath. She doesn't have to sit in the bath until she turns into a prune. Really, 20 minutes is enough. Okay, that's whatever. You can leave it up to your wives, but you should know that she doesn't have to be there. It's not that long. What I do get asked frequently, and which is a little unclear, is when is really the right time to do a chafifa? Meaning to say, so, you know, nowadays in the winter it's not really so relevant anyway, because, you know, during the daytime, it's, for most people, they can't do their chafifa then anyway. Either they're working, they have kids at home, whatever. So you anyway end up doing your chafifa at night, so you could do it in the mikveh, you could do it at home. As long as you take the hour that's prescribed, that's fine. In the summer, it becomes a little bit more relevant, where it's you can't go to the mikveh till let's say 9 or 9:30, and your kids are all asleep at 7, so technically you could do your chafifa already by day. When is the right time to do a chafifa? So the main thing is, a chafifa is not supposed to be too far away from the tefillah. The chafifa is not supposed to be a big hefsik in between your chafifa and your tefillah. So ideally, what it says in Shulchan Aruch is, the best time to do a chafifa is partially by day and partially by night. That's the best time to do a chafifa. You start the chafifa by day, so let's say 8:30 is shkia, you started at 8, you ended at 9, you've done it the best way. But, I mean, over here you don't have it as much, but like in Lakewood, where it works with appointments, you don't just go to the mikveh, you make an appointment. And sometimes in the summer months, if you're a little bit late on the pickup, you can get appointment 11, 12, 1, if you're really late. You know, it can go really late. So if you're only going to the mikveh at 11:30 or 12 o'clock, and you're doing your chafifa at 9, that's not chachila. Then your bedikah should be done, your chafifa should be done later, closer to when you're actually going to the mikveh. Likewise, even though the halacha is that if you have a tefillah on Matzah Shabbos or Matzah Yantiv, you're supposed to be doing your chafifa Erev Shabbos or Erev Yantiv, but really that's a very big hafsik in between your chafifa and your tefillah. So even though that is what it says in Shulchan Aruch, but the most contemporary Paiskim nowadays will say no. Rather, do your main chafifa Matzah Shabbos, do something Erev Shabbos, cut your nails, do part of the chafifa Erev Shabbos, you know, take a good shower. But the main chafifa, where you sit in the bath and all that, that should be done as near to the tefillah as possible. One other thing I want to point out, people don't know, is that when you have a leil tefillah on the second night yantiv, for those that have had that, will appreciate the discomfort in that. But in any case, if you do have a leil tefillah on the second night yantiv, where there is without choice going to be a span of time in between your chafifa and tefillah, you did your chafifa erev yantiv. And on Yantiv, you can't shower and bathe, as we discussed at length in Elzman. So you're pretty much stuck. You have to rely on that chafifa. There is a chiyuv to do a minor washing. And a lot of women don't know this, which means you have to wash in the places that are the private parts, I guess, like under your arms and the genital areas. Those have to be washed. They have to be a major washing. There has to be soap, but you have to do something. So a woman can really do it when she goes into the mikveh if she wants. You know, she can take the mikveh water and use it. But the halacha Shulchan Aruch, once there's that much time in between your chafifa and your tefillah, so some form of washing needs to be done on those areas. That's a good thing to know. Now, we'll talk a little bit about harchakos. So, first of all, everybody has to, appreciate the chashivas of harchakis. Very often, when people complain, especially young married people, when they complain how difficult it is to keep Hilchos Nida, more often than not, they haven't been keeping the harchakis properly. Chazal were very, very talented, obviously, and Tamid Chachamim and Chachamim, and they understood human nature until the nth degree. And each one of these halakhos, as much as we do or don't understand them, they all have a very, very powerful effect on the relationship between a man and a wife. And if a person is not machmer, not doesn't keep all these halakhos properly, it's inevitable that it's going to make it very difficult and cause a michshel chas v'shalom in Hilchos Nida. And Chazal themselves, if you're familiar with the Midrashim, were very, very machmer on Hilchos. On Archakas is this famous medrash where a woman whose husband was a very renowned tzaddik, and he died young, and she went around with his tefillin from base medrash to base medrash, asking, can anybody tell me why it was that my husband died? What did he do wrong? And she encountered Eliyahu HaNavi. So you see, this woman was a Baal Smadrega. She met Eliyahu HaNavi, and he started interrogating her, and she said, really? He said, Imamish kept all the mitzvahs. Tell me, what did he do when you were in Nida? What did he do when you were doing Shiva Nikiyam? And as it turned out, that during Shiva Nikiyam, they didn't keep Harchakas. They kept Harchakas during when she was in Nida, when she was Aser, but once they started Shiva Nikiyam, he had thought that there wasn't a need to keep Harchakas, probably because, she's about to become Mutter anyway. And Eliyahu Navi said, Baruch HaMakom Shahargai. Maybe Shiva Shigben said he killed him, in other words, that he got his Einish for being Oiver and Divri Chazal in this world rather than in the next world. So Chazal, very, very makbid on Harchakas. It's a serious Issud Rabbanon, and it has a very big benefit. It makes keeping Hilchos Nida easy. So I'm not going to go through all the harchakas, but I just want to clarify a couple of things. When it comes, especially with passing babies, is where things get confusing. So you're not allowed to pass, obviously, and you're not allowed to pass. There's no hetter in harchakas, the fact that there's company, the fact that it's embarrassing. Obviously, you do have to make it. It's in your best interest and it's in your chiyuv to make sure that things should be as least noticeable as possible and as not obvious as possible. And I have a whole list of ideas for everybody. If we want to know afterwards, is every one of them we can be worked out with mother-in-laws, sister-in-laws, nosy people around. It can be worked out that people shouldn't notice. But that having been said, so if there's no other option, there's no other option. So now you want to pass a baby to your wife, she's an idiot, you're not allowed to pass a little baby. A toddler who's able to already reach out for your spouse, that you can pass because that's not considered your giving, it's considered the baby is gone. But if a newborn baby or up to like one or when the baby's still very little, you can't pass the baby. So the easy thing is, especially when it's a little baby, you usually have a car seat around anyway, so you just keep the car seat in between you, and if you need to pass the baby, you put the baby in the car seat, and your wife will take the baby. It makes it a little less obvious. Now, where it gets complicated often is at night, when if your wife is nursing, so then, she's zonked and whatever, she doesn't sleep half the night as it is, so she wants you to bring her the baby, and she wants you to take the baby from her after she finishes nursing. And I don't know if you've all tried, but I've tried, trying to balance the baby, the edge of the bed, not good. Not worth it. So don't go that route. What you can do, my father-in-law asked this to Rav Gusman, and he said that in this case specifically, to put the baby on your wife and to take the baby off your wife, and that's not, her hands are not getting involved, she's not passing you the baby, it's just the baby's laying on her, you can put the baby on her and take the baby off her, and that's not called passing her or taking it from her. So that should make people's life much easier. Unless you're using this as an excuse not to get up. And I'm sorry, they have to tell your wives. So that's a heter in passing. But other than that, you can't pass any of these things. Now, when it comes to passing, obviously, as long as you put it down, it's fine, right? Now, the one exception to this is passing wine. Wine in Chazal has a special chumrah. Now, it's important to understand why. Why is it that wine is different? Because the reason is because sending wine specifically from a kashal bracha to your wife was considered a very special thing that a husband did for a wife. If you want a comparison nowadays, and not that this is usher, but I'm just giving you an idea, when you bring home food from a bris from your wife, for your wife, that was the concept of sending wine to your wife. Same idea as a segula. It's a special segula. Some women are very makbid on it. They get very insulted if you don't do it. There's a Gemara that says that Rav Nachman didn't send wine from the Kesha Bracha to his wife, and she got so angry that she went down to the cellar and broke 400 barrels of wine. So it was something very important, and it was a big school. It meant something to them, you know. They appreciated what the segula was and what the power of that segula was, and they were justifiably angry. So in any case, whether or not your wife has that particular hakpada, that's why there's a problem with passing wine. Now, that having been said, that's why it doesn't make a difference if you put it down or you don't put it down, because it's not, the isser is not the typical isser of passing. The isser is sending wine to your wife, so it doesn't make a difference how you do it. You can't send wine to your wife. Now, therefore, it's good to know that the other way is okay, which means, let's say you're by your father-in-law's father, etc., someone else's house, right? And the balabas made kiddush, and then he puts it into his little cups, and he gives you one cup, okay, this is for you, and then he gives you another cup, okay, this is for your wife. You could pass that to your wife. You put it down, obviously, you know, you can't pass it hand to hand, but there's no wine problem, because it's not you sending it to your wife, it's him sending it to your wife. That's okay. But the other, conversely, you, if you're the balabas and you're making kiddush, you can't say, okay, Chaim, pass this to my wife. That you can't do, because then you're sending it. So you could just, what the eitz is that you, especially if you have guests, you pour a couple of cups, and then you just start passing it, and hopefully the person will understand by himself, without you telling him where it should go. He'll pass the first one to your wife, or whatever. But then you can't designate one for your wife, even if you yourself are not actually handing it to her. It makes no difference, because you can't send wine to your wife. That's the problem. You can't send wine from a kaisel bracha to your wife. It gets uncomfortable. Many people have the minig by the Pesach Seder. You don't pour yourself your cup of Kiddush and the Arba Kaisis because it's Derech Cheres, the Melech. You expect to be poured. And if you and your wife are Usher, and if you're guests by someone else, and you know they're expecting you'll pour your wife and your wife will pour you, and that's not permitted. So, you know, the best thing is try to arrange the seating or find yourself on the other side of the table when that happens to avoid these issues. But that also would be a problem. I'm sorry? Making a Seder? So then what you do is you drink from your kais and then you put it down. And she'll take it. So she knows when you're between yourselves. It's communication. What?
Wine grapes are the same thing?
Yeah. Yeah, wine grapes are the same thing. Well, I'm sorry?
Just
yeah, fresh, that's right.
Pour for you also?
I believe so, yeah. I don't know if it says that before, but I think it's the same. That's fine, also. As long as it's not directly passing to her, it's okay.
But by Pesach, would it be different where it's like, can you do it and everybody's pouring for each other, or even there you can just pour a cup?
You shouldn't. It's better not, then. Yeah. I'm sorry?
I thought the issue was pouring the wine.
No, you're sending wine to your wife, regardless how. Okay, there are some paiskim, I will mention, there are some paiskim that hold that the whole thing doesn't apply nowadays for this reason, because, you know, the whole hakpada doesn't really apply. So there were some paiskim. There was someone that published a sefer on Hilchos Nidah. It was actually a very good sefer. He left out this halacha, but he got bombarded for it. So then he reprinted the sefer subsequently and included it. So it's not a popular psak, but there is a psak. There are people that hold like that.
Are you allowed to bring food home from a bris?
Yes, you are allowed to bring it. You should bring home certainly bring home food from a bris. Join the rest of us, you know, with our little things. Okay. Okay, just a little bit about Vestas before we finish. So the Aleph is, when you're making the cheshbon of Vestas, the most common error that is made is when you're counting, how do you count? So we already said, you start counting from the day that the flow began. Now, when you count, hopefully whoever you learned with as a chassan reiterated this many times, you double count, right? Which means that, like when you're counting a haflaga, so you start from the last period and till this period, and then that amount of time till the following period, right? So she had, the last period was 30 days ago, so in 30 days hence will be the haflaga. So when you count that, you count the day she had the last period, let's say it was on a Monday, you count that day, till this day's period, which let's say was on a Sunday. So you count both days as the number. So by including both days, the day of the last period, including days, let's say it equals 32, fine. Now you have 32. Now you start again from the day that you've already counted as part of the 32. You count it again when starting to the next month to figure out when 32 will be the next month. So it's important always to realize that the day, you always count both days and include it in the number. and don't exclude it, you'll end up with the wrong number. Again, so if you saw your, if I would have a calendar here, it would be easier. But if you saw on a Monday, and then you saw again on a Sunday, so you count from Monday to Sunday, and then you start counting again from Sunday to whatever number it is, it ends up being. Now, if a woman, what do you have to do on the day of the vest? What you have to do on the day of the vest, the ayna of the vest, which means if it was by day, day, or if it happened by night, all you have to do is you have to separate from your wife, that's mekar din, obviously, and you have to do a bedika, that's mekar din. One bedika. And Shulchan Aruch says, all it says you have to do is one bedika. There are minhagim to do two bedikas. Also something Rav Gusman told my father. Rav Gusman was a big rav in New York, previously in Europe. He was on Rav Chaim Eiser Grzanski's Bezdin. But he said one is enough, and that's the way I always taught, that one bedika on a vest is enough, and it doesn't have to be done first thing in the morning. It can be done any time during the day. Very often, the first thing in the morning isn't the right time to do a bedika, very dry. So it can be done any time during the day. That bedika can be done as long as it's done one bedika during that day. That's what you have to do. Now, what happens if you forget that bedika? So then, that's it. You lost it. There is one vest, that's the vest of Ayna Beninus, the 30-day vest. That bedika, if you forget that bedika, you are not permitted to be together with your wife until that bedika is done. So the other vest is Yema Chaydesh or Haflaga. If you forget that bedika, that's it. You lost it, missed it. But the vest of Ayna Beninus, if that vest, that bedika is not done, you are not permitted to be together with your wife until that bedika is done. So as soon as you remember, you do the bedika and you're immediately mutter right afterwards, but that bedika needs to be done. That's the difference, the key difference between Ayna Beninus and the other vestas. A very, very good practice, which everybody should enact, is that as soon as a woman gets her period, whoever it is that does the vestas, whether it's you or your wife or together, it should be done immediately. If you wait, then you tend to forget exactly when you got the period and you have to start counting backwards from when you went to the mikveh, and it gets complicated and it gets fakis and it's not worth it. You find yourself at the time that you might have a vest away in a hotel and you don't have access to your papers. So cheshbon the vest immediately, write it down right away. It's a very, very good practice and you save yourself from a lot of yisurim. The last thing I just want to mention before the last couple of minutes is that certain halachas of vestas can change when a woman is on birth control. If the way birth control works is that while you're taking the active dose, it prevents you from getting your period, and when you finish the dose, it causes you to get your period. So there's two aspects to it. So in other words, while you're on the pill itself, you're not going to get a period, and once you're off, you actually know when you're going to get your period because it causes it. A lot of women can tell you exactly 2 days after I finish my pill or 3 days after I finish my pill. So that can have an effect on a vest. So if for whatever reason a vest ended up in the middle of a time that you're taking a pill, you don't necessarily have to keep that vest. Obviously, you give me a call, but I'm telling you to be aware that taking a pill makes a difference both ways, when exactly the vest is and whether you have to keep it if it happens in the middle. So if the person is on the pill, you should consult with a rav. What I also want to say, as far as pill birth control is concerned, is that birth control bichlal is something that should be administered only with a rav. There is a misconception in the world. When I was teaching Chasanim also, that it always made very clear to Chasanim that they shouldn't think that Rabbanim are anti-birth control. It's quite the opposite. The Rabbanim are the biggest proponents of birth control. But it has to be done with a rav. There's a certain way it's done, a certain mahalach, a certain amount of time, when it's proper, when it's, you know, it's not a carte blanche type of thing. So it does have to be done while pi atzas a rav, and so it's important that you should work together with the rav, and with that way, if you do, you know, with your shemayim and with keeping the right things in mind, you'll have the biggest atzlacha. The last thing I want to mention is that we've mentioned before, if a person goes to a doctor, so the doctor does various different procedures, there's a very limited amount of procedures that actually can cause a woman to become anida. Most of the time she won't. The procedure itself won't make her usher, almost always. This is like one or two rare ones. But you should ask, you know, get the name of the procedure and ask, you know, whether that procedure itself made a problem. Though, what issue is, certain procedures do cause a woman to bleed. Notably, the insertion of an IUD can cause a woman to bleed. And that is a very big shaila, what the halacha with that dam is. So that's something to be on top of. if, you know, a woman is having an IUD inserted, so you should speak it up with the Rav, try to time it in a time where she's asked her anyway, that's the best, you know, you avoid that problem, but otherwise, it has to be discussed. So that's a good thing to keep in mind. So to summarize real quick, what we covered over here is, we covered how a woman, besides the Shalom Bayis part, for those who missed that, but we covered how a woman becomes an Ida, the difference between a flow and a drop of dam when it's inside the guf, or a kesem. We covered how to count 5 and 7. We covered that the bedikas have to be done, how they have to be done, and we covered hefsek tyre after shkia. And we spoke about the different colors and how to the chafifa has to be done as close to tefillah as possible. We discussed the importance of our chakas and passing babies to your wife and taking a baby from your wife, passing wine. And we discussed the difference between Aina Beninis and other Vestas, when you forget to make a Bedika, and to write the Vestas immediately, and how you Cheshbon Vestas when you are on the pill. And lastly, we discussed taking birth control and doctor procedures. You always consult with your Rav. And we should all be Zeichet to Kedusha and Tahara.